Robert Eisenberg, it's nice to meet you.
Great to meet you.
I've already made my my complete admission to you that I've not read the book. So we're talking. I just want everybody to know.
It's something to look forward to.
It is, and I do, too, even when I was reading about it. The Green Season. Not your first writing. You've been writing for a long time. But this one actually caught our eyes because you'd be presenting at the Arizona Humanities Center. What took you to Costa Rica? Why this country?
Good question. So basically, my wife and I were both in our terminal degree programs. She was getting her PhD. I was working on my MFA. And then we were approaching being done. And we're like, you know, we can move anywhere. We can do anything. And we're not tied to a school. And for what it's worth, we're not from Pittsburgh, but we were there for a long time.
You're usually from Vermont, right?
That's right, yeah. And I spent 15 years in Pittsburgh. It's still my favorite place in the world. I love it there. It's just such a wonderful, positive place to live and is just blossoming in wonderful ways. But I knew that if I didn't experiment with living somewhere else, I'd just stay there forever. So we basically triangulated a place that we were both interested in. I wanted to go somewhere warm and somewhere that struck me as exotic, but also wasn't too difficult to move to. You know, people recommended like Colombia and, you know, just lots of very, very, what to me were ambitious places to live. And I didn't want to.
Ambitious or just downright dangerous?
Well, you know, a lot of places are surprising. They're, once you take the first step and the second step, like it falls into place and you figure out what's reasonable. But Costa Rica is very easy to move to. It's it has streamlined the process for aspiring expats, and there's less to be concerned about. You know, you can get a lease in English, and you can lease a place for the 3 months that you're allowed to stay on a tourist visa, and it's a reasonable thing. And my wife has always loved Spanish and has always loved Latin culture. And so we were like, you know, Costa Rica is a very stable place. It's got a lot of admirable qualities, a lack of military. They really celebrate their environment. And those were all things that really appealed to us. So we gave it a shot.
Your wife loves Spanish, mm-hmm. the language, loves the idea of Latin American culture. Were you familiar? Did you share the love?
We actually bonded on our first date because we had both sort of accidentally, for different reasons, ended up in Cuba. She went to a Quaker school in Philadelphia, and they did a kind of a mission trip. She just had a transformative experience when she was a teenager. And I ended up there on semester at sea, and I was just there as a student. And we ended up, all 1,000 students from the ship ended up in a room with Castro. And he did, I believe, an 8-hour speech. And I mean, it's just these experiences are things that you can never replicate.
You're 16, so we're talking 20 years ago.
Yeah, it was.
So it wasn't Raul.
It was 2000.
It wasn't exactly. Raul talking for you.
It was Fidel.
Wow.
And whatever one's impression of his politics, it was just such a tremendous thing for, you know, in terms of life experience. And I had been a little bit to Mexico and so on, but I'm drawn to everywhere. There are very few places I don't want to go to. I was game for almost anything. I had been at that point, I believe, to 34 countries around the world, but I never had an address there. And this was the one I wanted to be my first expat experience. That said, the joke in Costa Rica is that no one actually does have an address. The addresses are very confusing. It's like, you know, Red Church, 30 meters north, 50 meters to the west.
Try addressing an envelope to that.
I can't imagine. I pity anyone who tried to send me a postcard.
So when you're going to Costa Rica, you have, I'm sure you do research. You're finding out, where am I going? What's going on? What is there to do? What surprised you?
I think we did a couple of investigative visits. So the first trip was 10 days. And we were like, you know, we know so little about this country. We could be robbed on the way out of the airport and have a terrible time and go back and be like, all right, well, we're not moving there. That was not the case. We were surprised by San Jose. It's a very dark and rainy city. And it's usually perceived as pretty ugly. It's not representative of the Costa Rican experience that everyone wants. But I think what really struck us was the incredible diversity. It has 5% of the world's biodiversity. And the way to explain that is if there were only 100 species on Earth of all animals, all organisms, five of them would live just in Costa Rica. And that's just an astonishing thing. It's just brimming with life. It's about, the whole country is about half the size of Pennsylvania in terms of square mileage. But there's no chunk of it that doesn't feel like Siberia. I mean, it's just so vast in spirit, and it's so dense. And everywhere that you hike, everywhere that you drive, you really have to take your time, and you really have to see everything in order to really appreciate what the country has to offer.
And for city dwellers, when you're saying dense, you're not talking about population. You're talking about, I'm assuming, flora and fauna.
Yes, and also mountains, volcanoes, rivers, beaches. I mean, it's just a very geographically dynamic country.
What did you encounter in cuisine? I'm assuming, are you eating a lot of restaurants? Are you eating people's homes? Are you buying food and making yourself?
It's such a misconception, because everyone pictures Mexican food.
Right.
And it's such a simple diet. It's a lot of rice and beans. My favorite thing, and it became a metaphor in the book, is casado. And casado technically means married, but the idea is that it's a marriage of lots of different types of food on a plate. So you have your rice, you have your beans, you have salad, and you have some kind of meat. And then you oftentimes have like a postres, like a dessert afterward. And then fruit juice, which, so good. So you bring all of these things together, and it's just the perfect lunch. It's like perfectly healthy. It's perfectly filling. It's like $4. And I just became addicted to it. And it was so great working for a newspaper, because we have our news team. And then at lunch, we'd all go out and we'd all, try not to complain, but we'd all like sort of gossip about all the things that had gone on that day. And it was just, you have a 2-hour lunch, and it just feels so, it feels so right, you know?
So I missed that. You're actually on the payroll when you're there.
Exactly. So we didn't want to just show up in a place, and couldn't have afforded to just show up in a place and just live there. And there are a lot of like beach bums and, people who volunteer or who are woofers. And I really respect that and any approach that you might have to a country. But we needed to be solvent. And I've been a freelance writer for years and years, and I couldn't imagine not doing it. So I applied with the Tico Times. And the Tico Times is, the way I always put it, is it's the most distinguished English language newspaper in Central America. It's been around since 1956. It started as a class project at an English school and evolved into this very well-respected weekly newspaper. And when I applied there, it just happened to be in transition, as a lot of newspapers are, from a weekly paper to a daily digital version. This was perfect, because I had written for MSN, I had written for a lot of online media, and there were just so many things I wanted to do, and they were not desperate for content, but they were very enthusiastic about people helping them in a very driven way.
When you're writing then for Tico,
mm-hmm. The Tico Times.
Tico Times, is your target indigenous peoples, or are you talking to expats?
It's such an interesting question. Basically, it's an English speaking audience. So a lot of those people are expats. A lot of those people are people who are based in the United States or Canada or Britain or wherever. And they want to get their news in English, and they're not necessarily in Costa Rica, but they have a strong connection to it. Maybe they own a hotel, or they have a timeshare. They want to know what the daily news is. Also students, people who are Ticos, they are native Costa Ricans, but they are learning English, and they want a practical way to practice English.
Brilliant. Yeah. So I see the publisher of the books is Tico Times.
Yeah. So what happened was the owner, Jonathan Harris, who's just a brilliant, really interesting guy. He's one of the most voracious readers I've ever met. I had thought about putting together a book like this in the style of Slouching Toward Bethlehem or, David Foster Wallace's essays, where they were previously published works, but then could come together as a book with a kind of coherent blue line. when I was talking with him about this, I was like, you know, I'd like to offer this manuscript that I've put together to you as something that you could publish. And it's a sure thing for me because I would have found a publisher. And it would help the Tuco Times sort of expand its audience. And he loved the idea. It was a wonderful conversation. And he ended up telling me that he had always dreamed of having a press. And this was the result. This was sort of the
first book.
The first book.
Wow.
So now we have a couple more that are scheduled. They're coming out sometime later this year. As far as I can tell, it's going very well. We've been very excited about it.
Well, congratulations on being the first.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's talk about the book specifically, The Green Season. Tell me about the title.
One of the many ways that Costa Rica brands itself well is it takes the 6 months of the year that are the rainy season, and they call it the green season. And the tourism ministry sort of pats itself on the back for coming up with this. But it's true that when the rain falls hardest, the country is most alive. Everything blooms. Everything comes out of the woodwork. And what can be a very dry country and very, very brittle and brown just becomes this just lush, beautiful place. And it became a metaphor for me and my wife, where being an expat is hard. I mean, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of confusion. It's a lot of bureaucracy. And you don't necessarily know where you stand with the country, especially in such a short time where we're only there 2 years. So for us, it was almost like a green season where it was, you know, you're constantly pummeled by these unexpected problems. And at the same time, you just feel so enlivened by the experience, and everything is exciting.
Well, and again, for desert dwellers, what is the green season from this month to which month?
You know, it doesn't correspond to anything.
Really?
Anywhere else. Yeah, no, I found it very confusing. It basically starts toward the end of April into May, and then continues, sort of reaches a crescendo around October, just in time for my birthday, and then peters out around December.
So it's the rainy season when the rain starts, mm-hmm. and when it dunes, we're done.
Exactly. But again, it's kind of confusing because living in San Jose, the mornings would be very bright and sunny year round. And then it was around like 1 o'clock that the clouds started to gather. And then at its height around October, you'd have the rain start just gushing around 2 o'clock and then continue sometimes long into the night. And so you had these beautiful mornings, but then they were followed by these just epic downfalls. But it's not like Forrest Gump where it starts raining and, you know, doesn't stop for 6 months, you know.
But it could seem that way for a day or more.
It could seem like that, yeah.
So I remember my daughter saying, it's been raining for 3 days. I'm ready to go outside. when you undertake writing a book like this, when you're pitching it, I'm assuming after the fact, to the owner of Tuco Times.
Yeah, okay. It was what I originally put together was everything. You know, everything that I liked was put into this manuscript. And then I started to carve away the pieces that didn't make sense for continuity or that wouldn't make sense to a U.S. audience or felt too much like an inside joke. And what I ended up with were the pieces that I felt were strong enough and related to each other enough to kind of have a running narrative. And while most of, I would say the majority of them, the subject is not me or my wife, it has an autobiographical quality that sort of pulls everything together.
So the idea really was to take what you had written there for the paper or the online Tuco Times and say, make a book out of that. So when you're whittling down, you're going to those essays and saying, well, nobody gets that part. Let's pull that out. But then craft a narrative. We write for different reasons. And when you're writing this to people like me who've not been there, I'm your audience and you want me to get an experience. But there's always the experience the writer takes away of maybe even better understanding what he's been through for the last 2 years. What do you want folks who haven't been or who pick up the book, and what do you want us to get?
What I think has been lacking, and this, I'm trying not to sound too self-satisfied about it, but what I think has been lacking about the literature about Costa Rica is that most of the books that are printed in the United States or for an English-speaking audience are either guidebooks or they're pure memoir, which are usually okay. self-published. And there's nothing wrong with any of these. Like, I relied heavily on guidebooks, and I love Lonely Planet. I've written for Lonely Planet. Like, I really enjoy that approach because it helps you figure out what's going on. But these aren't really stories. They're helping you tell your story and, you know, have experiences abroad. And the memoirs, like, usually were sort of self-involved. It's like, this is my experience in this place, and this is how I transformed as a person, and this is the epiphany that I had, which is great, but they don't necessarily have anything to do with what Costa Rica is. That was just the setting. And these are the people they met and so on. And what my editor told me, or I'm sorry, what Jonathan Harris told me, the publisher, was don't write like a travel writer. Don't write like a foreigner who happens to be here. This is the Tico Times, not the Gringo and Central America Times. And you should write as an authoritative figure. And so while I can't entirely be convincing in that capacity, this is my best effort, is to write about themes that are relevant to Costa Ricans and sort of be a bridge between Costa Ricans and everybody else.
When do you have your wife read your work?
Oh, yes.
Is she an editor for you?
Actually, every time I mention her in an essay, I push the Word file toward her and I say, please look this over and make sure that it's accurate and you're comfortable with it.
So, yeah, it's not the spell check function or the dangling participles. It's more, am I being true to what we did?
Exactly.
What was her reaction when she started reading? Because I'm assuming she'd read the pieces. So now she's seeing you create the narrative from features you've written or stories you've written along the way, and now you've edited them to make that narrative. What'd she think?
I've never met anyone more supportive, and I surround myself with supportive people. It's the only way I can do this. From my parents to, you know, to my just many, many friends and colleagues. They've always sort of pushed me along and had nice things to say. But Kylan is the one who really, if something doesn't make sense to her, then I don't do it. And if it does make sense, then I know I'm really onto something. We've just understood each other very well the past 11 years. And she's the ultimate go-to for me.
I chose a very similar person, and I don't go anywhere or do anything. She doesn't tell me it's okay.
Great minds think alike.
That's what I'm flattering myself to think. What kinds of culture did you encounter? I mean, beyond food, beyond...
I think what's so striking about Costa Rica, every time I went to work, I would walk down Avenida Central, which is like right in the middle of San Jose, appropriately enough. And I would see all these people, I mean, just this ocean of people all walking along this, I would say, 5-block, maybe even longer than that. It was this very long pedestrian walkway. And it's just filled with hawkers and tourists and, you know, just everybody ends up there at some point. And it would always strike me that there was no Tico look. Like there's nothing you can point to physically in a person and say, oh, that's a Costa Rican look.
Okay.
There are tall people, there are short people, there are black people, there are people who are paler than I am, which is really saying something. You know, just so many different types of fashions, so many different types of just body types. It's so rich, just genetically rich. I think the culture really reflects that. There are phrases in Spanish that are specific to Costa Rica, like a sarpe is the last drink of the night. And if you go to Nicaragua or you go to Panama, like they've never heard of this phrase.
Really?
And things like that. You know, it's the Pura Vida attitude is so specifically Costa Rican. If you go to the Caribbean coast, it was largely settled by Afro-Caribbean people who came to build the railroads. And stuff like that, I mean, as a tourist, if you go there for your wedding, as I did, you know, you would be at a resort and you might never learn anything like that. And the second you hear that, you're like, wait, like Jamaicans were brought over in the late 19th century to build the railroads across this mountainous jungle? Like, that's incredible. And then stayed and then have had a very contentious history with Spanish Costa Ricans and they've very gradually started to integrate. It's that kind of subtlety was what really excited me about Costa Rica. Like you can figure it out very, very quickly, sort of the basics. And then you learn about the Brunca people, which is one of my favorite bunches of people to visit. They're this indigenous group. They're only a few thousand. Their language is about to die out. But they create these incredible masks out of single pieces of balsa wood and then paint them these vibrant colors. And you see them at the airport, but, you know, you're like, where did these come from? Like, what's the significance of it? And in the book, I went to visit them during one of their festivals. And there's just no way you can anticipate how powerful those masks are to those people. So it took a lot of work, and it was always rewarding.
When you're talking about what I'll say Central Avenue, because that's what we have here, when you're on that place and they're hawking things, they're, you know, again, my sense is usually it's things that have been made. Are they selling to each other, or are they selling to people who are visiting? Because when you go down a market, you know, in Cleveland, for crying out loud, if you're in the farmer's market, there's a level of authenticity to it. If you're out on the street, then it's stuff, you don't know what this is. Somebody's just trying to sell me a watch. I don't know. But when you're, what are they selling? What are you buying?
You know, it didn't end up in the book, but around Christmas time, two Christmases ago, I wrote an entire essay about these hawkers and the experience of being a shopper around the holidays. And visiting these stores that really I would never think to visit any other time of year, there are a lot of imports. There's a lot of stuff that comes from China, lots of knockoffs, all that. Avenida Central is not really like the ideal place for it, for the authentic Costa Rican culture that we always think of. And what's sort of surprising is that mall culture, like what we think of as like 1980s style shopping malls, is still very popular in Costa Rica. They actually built, I think, the largest one in Central America last year and opened it. And I mean, people travel from Guatemala just to go to this mall because it's still very exciting and novel to them. And when you don't have consistent street addresses and you don't have an Amazon.com, you can't just order something and send it to your house. Like, this is a reason to go out with your sometimes very large family. So it was an interesting phenomenon, but for such a developed country, it was still very exciting to go to a small village and find that they were known for something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think, kind of rare in the U.S. in the era of agribusiness, to show up in a town and find that they're known for like one thing. You know, there's a town that's known for chairs or guitars or as having the best coffee beans, the best soil for it. Turrialba has a cheese that's so distinct that they just call it Turrialba cheese.
Really?
And you always know what they're talking about. And that's so striking. I can't imagine the pride of growing up in Turrialba, ending up somewhere else in the country, and always going to a supermercado and seeing this cheese that has your town's name on it. You know, it's just got to, like, you know, it's got to warm your heart at least a little bit.
I think maybe you're seeing this too. I mean, you're younger than I, but there was this plummeting toward the culture that we're trying to get away from now. When you talk about them, I'm never complaining about driving to a mall again. If it's, turn left at the boat. I don't know. Where you get off the roadways and you get onto the interstates, and you lose all the culture along the way, just in this country. By God, I'm so old I can remember. Driving across the country, hearing dialect.
Mm.
Radio was different.
Right.
You see that now when you drive north in Arizona and all of a sudden you're in Navajo land and that's the station. I don't understand what they're talking about, but they make good radio.
Right.
It's really cool. Just drive, you don't know what they're talking about, but it's really fun to listen to.
Absolutely.
And you saw all across the country places that were famous for their widget, whatever the widget was.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like we're in this car, we're braking and trying to careen it back because you're seeing it. You know, there are places that are known for
that. And that was, compounding on that, that was very exciting to be learning Spanish and to learn it just well enough that I could start to hear the different dialects within the country.
Mm.
And so I could talk to Afro-Caribbean people and hear, you know, the patois sneaking into their sentences. And even as nearby as a town called Cartago, which is, I think it's like 15 kilometers from downtown San Jose, has a distinct dialect, which granted everyone makes fun of, but it's having lived so many years in Pittsburgh where there's a distinct dialect, it really charmed me. And what they often do is they put an SH sound at the end of an infinitive. So it's like, "Quieres comer?" And it's like, it's just this like really like cute, like campesino, like specific to Cartago dialect.
It's like Cartago Yiddish or something.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're here in the Valley. You've been living here, you say, for about a year now. You've been living here.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah, it'll be a year this month.
So the vagabond spirit, how long do you think you'll be here?
Well, it's interesting timing. I love Phoenix. And although I knew very little about it before I moved here, we moved here because my wife got essentially her dream job at ASU. And I started adjuncting there, and it's just been a dream come true. We've been having a blast. I'm loving living in the desert. I think Phoenix is really evolving at an incredible rate toward a destination that I'm very, very interested in. And I could see spending at least a few years, if not a long time here. I lost track of what I was going to say.
This is why we can edit.
Exactly. I'm so glad this isn't live. So, what was the other part of your question? So, what's striking about this particular time is that we just adopted our son from China in December.
So, congratulations.
Thank you so much. So, we had only been in Phoenix for about 6 months before once again our life radically changed, and we were in China for 16 days. We pick up Leo, who is just the most rambunctious and wonderful two-year-old I could have possibly imagined. He's like a checklist for everything we wanted in a person, and brought him back, and have now had, 6 months of sleepless nights and lots of running around, Papago Park. So the vagabond spirit is sort of on hold for a little bit, but we've now, I think, bonded so closely with each other that we can start, prepping for the next adventures.
Mm-hmm. Be interesting to see what Leo does to those plans.
Hopefully embellish them, yeah, if there's any indicator.
Right. Well, the green season, and Robert, thank you so much. It's been fun to hear your stories. And again, we'll let everybody know that they can come on the 7th, the Humanities Council, and hear all about it.
Sterling, thank you so much.